Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And of course, you just heard a recording of Neil Armstrong taking the first steps on the moon. So we'll be talking today about that flight and the history of NASA on the show with our guest, John Logsdon. John, one of the foremost experts on space policy and history in America. He founded the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University, former member of the NASA Advisory Council, editor of a 7-volume NASA history titled Exploring the Unknown. And his latest book is The Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, NASA and the Incredible Story of Human Space Flight. I really enjoyed this book, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy listening to John Logsdon as he talks about the space program and its history. And you may have some questions about the space program. I hope you do. What do you think about sending humans to Mars? That's another thing we can bring up. And John Logsdon, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning. Glad to be there.
Well, that clip we just played of Neil Armstrong, pretty iconic. I'm old enough to. I was just a kid when that happened at the neighbor's house watching because they had a better television set, and it was pretty cool. But as we think about the space program, what do you think most people know about how the whole thing came about?
Well, I think they associate the Apollo program with President Kennedy and his 1961 decision to enter the space race with the intent of winning it, his 1962 speech at Rice University, where he said, "We do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard." The Apollo 8 mission around the moon, Christmas Eve, 1968, with the iconic Earthrise photo that Bill Anders took and the crew brought back, and then Armstrong stepping on the moon.
Well, your book is a compilation of historical documents, which I found absolutely fascinating. But of course, you had a 7-volume history here, and I think in the foreword you talk about how you happened to put these together into a sort of a brief, in a way, summary. How did you determine what to put in and leave out?
That was hard. It was painful because even with the documents in the Penguin book, I had to cut pieces out of it to get it within a reasonable, readable size. It fundamentally was my judgment of what mixture of historically important documents and human interest material and maybe even a flash of humor now and then would captivate the reader and communicate the excitement of what we've done by sending very few of us. There have only been, from the United States, 460 or so people that have gone into orbit or beyond. Only 24 that have gone beyond Earth orbit.
Yeah, and I really found those reports fascinating. And John Glenn's letter, I think, to a friend that you had included in there, Jim Lovell is the commander of Apollo 13, and his description of what went on, it just absolutely fascinating. But you mentioned, you know, most of us think about President Kennedy as the person who started everything, but really it was President Eisenhower who actually got the whole program going.
Indeed. I mean, the book really has two aspects to it. One is the origin. Pardon me, I have a persistent cough. The first part of the book talks about why NASA was created, how the United States started a space program, and then the rest of the book focuses on human spaceflight. And indeed, it was Eisenhower and his associates that said, how do we react to Sputnik? We need to figure out how to organize a U.S. space effort. And the decision was made to have a new, separate civilian agency, open in all it did, able to cooperate with other countries, in contrast to the secretive Soviet program. So Indeed, it was Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson, at that time the majority leader of the Senate, who kind of shepherded the bill that created NASA through the congressional process.
Yeah, and I think the thinking on, you know, not wanting to have, you know, if you had them together, defense and a civilian thing together, that the tendency, I think, Ike thought, would be to spend more on the military side of it than the civilian side, if I'm remembering what you wrote in your book.
Well, I think Eisenhower was, first of all, was not enthusiastic about spending a lot of money on space in general because he was a fiscal conservative. And there had been this kind of media hysteria after Sputnik. So one of his goals was limiting the pressures from the public, from the media, to have a very active and very ambitious space program. He said the military requirements are actually more important. I mean, we don't have enemies on the moon. We have enemies in the Soviet Union. And we need to know what's going on there. So he gave first priority to the National Security Space Program and was kind of shrewd in saying, well, we'll have an open civilian program while on the other side we conduct a classified, secretive military program that will protect our security.
That was really some good thinking on his part. I think they, at that time, just not to spend all of our time on that, but the early times there, they kind of, Ike wasn't too worried about Sputnik going up before we had anything, but I think they were, as you write about, they were kind of surprised at the public reaction and the worry that came about because of it.
Yeah, I think there was a misreading, maybe even a misjudgment on the part of the Eisenhower administration that the public saw Sputnik as evidence that basically we couldn't hide behind oceans anymore, that the United States was open to threat from an adversary thousands of miles away. If they could put something in orbit, they could also lob a nuclear weapon onto our territory. And that created and politicians were going around saying the country that controls the earth, controls the sky, controls the earth. So there was a degree of public hysteria, and Eisenhower was very concerned about damping that down.
And, of course, Kennedy, when President Kennedy came into the program, he had a somewhat different view of the whole thing. Talk about his thinking versus Eisenhower's.
Well, as he became president, Kennedy hadn't thought much about space. And he wasn't all that interested in it. He gave control over the space program to his vice president, now Lyndon Johnson, as vice president rather than majority leader of the Congress, until 3 months after Kennedy took office, the Soviet Union launched Yuri Gagarin as the first human in space. And there, not only the U.S. reaction, but the world reaction was positive, and that this was evidence of Soviet capability in a zero-sum Cold War environment. Kennedy said, well, that's not acceptable. He was a competitive person. He said, find me a space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win.
And, you know, there was some discussion about, do we make this a manned space program, or, you know, we could do it a lot cheaper if we just used, you know, the robotic kinds of things that we were capable of doing. But the man aspect of it was critical, I believe, in their minds.
Indeed. The memo that went to Kennedy recommending setting a lunar landing as a national goal said, and I think I can almost quote it verbatim, it is men, not merely machines, that captures the imagination of the world. And the point of this accelerated space program was to impress other countries with U.S. power, U.S. technological capability. And so having humans involved was a critical part of making it impressive.
And so we've, you know, thinking about what we've had over the years, the first part of our program, I guess what you could call it, was the Mercury program.
Yes. Picked seven astronauts in 1959 and launched six of them. Deke Slayton never got launched. Basically to find out what would happen. We, at that point, did not know whether a human could survive the process of going into space with all the gravity loads in during the acceleration, then the rapid exposure to the absence of gravity, and then the reemergence of gravity coming back, whether a human organism could survive that. So Mercury is basically a program to put people in space and see what happened.
and frankly, and I guess we started with, didn't we start with a monkey?
Chimpanzee,
sorry.
Yeah. Well, there were monkeys also. There were rhesus monkeys, but the test missions for Mercury flew chimpanzees because they were closest to human in basic skeletal and metabolism.
But those seven astronauts pretty much immediately became almost like rock stars.
Indeed. And I don't think that was anticipated, that the public interest in what they were doing, their family life, who they were. This was back when there were weekly news magazines like Life magazine, and Life contracted with the astronauts. They were on covers. They and their families were on covers of this magazine frequently in those early years.
And I think it even created some issues for at the higher level of, okay, are we going to allow these guys to actually make money on this?
Indeed. I mean, they were, after all, government employees, not very well-paid government employees, kind of mid-rank government employees, with all the demands of celebrity. So John Glenn and President Kennedy and Kennedy's brother Bobby became fairly good friends after Glenn's flight in 1962. And Glenn said, look, my wife has to buy extra clothes. I have to buy suits. I can't do this on a government salary. So the money from the Life contract is essential for our being able to do what we're being asked to do. And Kennedy said, oh, okay. As long as you don't do, as a government employee, kind of unfair profit from this. Don't take free houses or free cars, for example.
The whole thing is really fascinating to me. We have many people online to visit with you as well. But just to follow up on Glenn's, that letter that John Glenn wrote that you include in the book, I thought was just absolutely fascinating because there were some problems in that flight.
Glenn's letter was during the training before the flight, and it went to the man that was Ross Perot's vice presidential candidate.
Yes.
Admiral Stockdale. But then you have Glenn's flight report where, there were indications that there might be problems with his heat shield on reentry. He was brought back a bit early, and he didn't know, and the ground didn't know whether he was going to survive or not. This was a risky business.
Yeah. Our guest today is John Logsdon, has written a fascinating book about NASA and the incredible story of human space flight. His book is titled The Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, NASA, and the Incredible Story of Human Space Flight. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the history of human spaceflight with our guest today, author John Logsdon, America's foremost expert on space policy and history, in my mind. And I'm sure if you read his book, you'll probably agree with me on that. Dennis in Racine will give you a chance. Dennis, hi.
Yes, hi. I kind of grew up with this space program, watching it on TV since I was a kid. We finally went to in that facility at Cape Canaveral 10 years ago in a room, the picture they took just recently. And I checked the data, and the Saturn launch vehicle was just incredible. The complexity, the fact that it worked so perfectly, almost every launch they had, and what it looked like taking off. You have to go there to see just what this looked like, how massive the project was. And Cage, a lot of talent, also interesting facts. I think Wernher von Braun was head of this project, the Moon project, at least through this Apollo Saturn V vehicle. Another German V2 rocket scientist was Kurt Van Swietlebos, who was head of NASA like 12 years during that period. And these two men, former German V2 rocket scientists, undertook some most incredible space development program in history, considering this moon. It was incredible what they did. Even today, you can see that rocket taking off. The plane was brighter than the sun, five engines, 7.5 million pounds.
I should comment. A lot of people watched all of this from Apollo 11. I was there. I was at the Kennedy Space Center on July the 16th, 1969, when Apollo 11 launched on the way to the moon. And seeing a Saturn V launch was a remarkable experience. The last one was at night, Apollo 17, and it really lit up the sky. So, yeah, I've seen some shuttle launches over the years, but nothing will compare to the Saturn V launches. I saw three of them, and they were something I'll never forget.
Yeah, and von Braun was kind of an outgoing guy too, and sort of served as I don't know if he was a front man, but he was certainly somebody that was in the public eye a bit.
Well, Dr. von Braun was a very charismatic person. I had a chance to interact with him a few times, and he was the kind of person that filled a room when he walked in. You knew he was there. He was the leader of the German team that built the Saturn V rocket. He didn't manage the rest of the program. The people at Johnson Space, it wasn't even Johnson Space Center then, Manned Spacecraft Center and NASA headquarters, weren't the kind of media personalities that von Braun was. So they kind of get neglected. But you've got the biopic of Neil Armstrong coming out in 3 weeks or so, First Man, and I think they'll get a fair amount of attention there.
Well, we've been talking about the Mercury probe. Maybe we'll, Torsten, we'll give you a chance from TOMA. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I just wanted to comment. I've always been extremely inspired by NASA, regardless of the fact that most of their endeavors have chiefly been militaristic and not so much scientific. But I think that that's greatly changing as, I guess, the whole notion of spaceflight and travel is becoming commercialized. And I wanted to know what you thought about that and the fact that now we have that reusability factor that has been proven to be safe and efficient with rockets.
Well, a couple things to say there. First of all, NASA's activities are not militaristic. I mean, after all, its robotic program of exploring the solar system, exploring the cosmos, has very little to do with military activity. Certainly the human spaceflight program is an element of our national posture, our national power, our sending a message to the world of American greatness, and to that degree it's related to our security, but it's not military. We have a military space program that's even larger, at least in budget terms, than NASA. Now we have the commercial sector actively getting involved, SpaceX with demonstrating reusability of its launch vehicles. And that's clearly the wave of the future, is reducing the cost so we can do more. Jeff Bezos of Amazon in a speech here in Washington yesterday said he's going to continue to put $1 billion of his money a year into developing space capability. That's all to the good.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And before we go back to the phones, we had the Mercury program, and then we kind of The next part of that program was called the Apollo program. And how did that what went on there in that transition?
Well, between Mercury and Gemini, there was between Mercury and Apollo, there was Gemini.
Yes, exactly right.
The two-person program, 10 launches in a two-year period that was basically inserted in the program once we decided we needed to rendezvous as part of getting to the moon, demonstrated spacewalk capability, and it was a very successful program that was critical to getting ready for Apollo. So two persons, up to 14 days in a tiny spacecraft. If you go and see one of the Gemini spacecraft and imagine two people spending 2 weeks in there, they had to get to be very good friends.
they did indeed. Paul in Madison, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Yes, good morning, Larry. I have three specific recollections of the space program as to seeing it on television. As a very young kid in elementary school on the now-closed Hoyt School, we would arrive early in the morning, and the janitor would wheel in the big TV set on the stand, and we'd excitedly watch the liftoff and Walter Cronkite announcing it. And then the summer of 1969, July 20th, being at the what was then called the Dane County Junior Fair inside the Coliseum, watching on closed circuit television, as they used to say, watching the lunar lander touch down and having to jockey for position just to get a space in the crowd to see that. Later that evening, sitting at home in front of our old Zenith black and white television set and breathlessly watching Neil Armstrong climbed down the ladder, and we still have that old black and white TV set down in the basement.
Well, that's the memory, I think, John, that a lot of people have.
Well, I've had the good fortune to build a career out of this stuff.
Yeah.
Let me interact with. I got to know Neil Armstrong fairly well. Another of my vivid memories is sitting over dinner in Huntsville, Alabama, somewhere along the line when we were both on the NASA Advisory Council, and listened to him talk about flying the landing pattern to land on the moon. You know, you're sitting there next to a world hero talking about how he did it. That was great.
Yeah, and you include in your book, there's he writes in the book about taking over manual control, I think, and landing.
Indeed. Neil was, first of all, a really super pilot. He loved any form of flight, and it was his skill as a pilot that made the Apollo 11 landing a success.
Yeah, I think was where they were originally going to drop down. He had to kind of move over a bit.
Yep.
To get sort of around it. Well, there were some tragedies through that program, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we had the Apollo 1 fire with Gus Grissom and Ed White and Roger Chaffee dying on the launch pad in Florida, and then the two in-flight accidents, Challenger and Columbia, during the shuttle program. So those 17 astronauts who died, plus some that died as they were doing activities related to the program. So, yes, it's a risky business, and it still is a risky business.
We've got a little clip from the Apollo 13 mission for anyone to live through it. Probably a lot of people have seen the Tom Hanks movie, but this is an original clip that Dave Potratz has put together for us. Dave, you want to play that?
13, we've got one more item for you when you get a chance. We'd like it to stir up your cryo tanks.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
Five guns.
Go guidance.
We've had a hardware restart. I don't know what it was.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main bus undervolt.
And we had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there.
Yeah, you've got some of Jim Lovell's, well, you have his sort of explanation of kind of what they did and what happened during that, which I found fascinating as well, John.
Indeed. And to be fair, the Apollo 13 movie does a pretty good job of recreating what happened. I mean, they had their oxygen tank in their spacecraft exploded, and as soon as that happened, they were not going to be able to land on the moon. The issue was how to get the crew back safely to Earth, and it took a lot of ingenuity on the part of the ground people and a lot of perseverance on the part of the crew to be able to do that.
Yeah, Lovell's report is really fascinating. Well, let's take another call. Vern and Boyd, it's your turn. Hi, Vern.
Why, yeah. I hate to say, maybe I'm more of an expert on rockets than you guys are. Now, you take the Challenger, for instance. This was conceived by Germany in 1945, and the United States wasn't going to build it. But now if you look at a videotape of Challenger number 7, the one Sally Ride was on, the O-ring was smoking, and NASA knew it when they brought these boosters back, and they let them continue until 25 blew up. And the shuttle is the worst space machine ever built. We are now using Russian engines, which were superior to ours in the Apollo program. They just couldn't get their systems working. They designed the rocket engine in 1898. They make the best engine, called full-cycle engine. They power our Atlas rocket now that we launch our satellites with. And
well, let's get. Thanks for calling, Vern, and bringing that up. Well, how accurate do you think Vern is on this, John?
Well, there are bits and pieces of inaccuracies, but. Let's take it bit by bit. There were various failures in the shuttle program from Flight 1 on through, but NASA was pressing to meet a schedule, and the shuttle was supposed to be routine, and there got to be a kind of mutual groupthink that the problems weren't that bad. That led to the launch of Challenger. So he's right. I mean, there were a whole history of problems with the vehicle prior to the Challenger accident in 1986. Challenger didn't come out of German design. I think he may be referring to a space plane designed by a man named Ugam Sanger back in Germany in the 40s. But the Challenger design was a U.S. design. Let's see, what was this? Oh, and the Russian engines. He's right. We invested in propulsion for the space shuttle main engines in the early 70s and then stopped investing. And so Russia has developed fairly simple, very reliable, and very effective engines, and we have not until recently. There's work by several companies to develop new engines.
And it brings to mind, just to go back to Kennedy for a minute, his view was always that we would share information. He actually wanted, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, wanted maybe that space flight to the moon to be a joint venture. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, he started out in his inaugural address saying to the Soviet Union, "Let us explore the heavens together." Then after Gagarin decided the United States had to compete, had to enter a race with the intent of winning. But by 1963, we had made enough progress and the world had changed after the Cuban Missile Crisis and seeking areas of agreement with the Soviet Union. He went to the UN on September 20th, 63, and basically said, let's do it together. 2 months later, he was dead and that idea died with him.
Yeah. Well, we'll take another call. Brad in Mequonigo has been waiting a while here. Brad, what's on your mind?
Can you hear me good?
Yes.
Great. Two questions. First question, and I'll try and make it as brief as possible. In 1956, was Wernher von Braun ordered by General Bernard Shriver to stop? But he was told to put the third or fourth stage of the Jupiter C to the side, so that allowed the Soviets to launch Sputnik first. The second question is, are the microelectronics now used in spacecraft robust enough if an accident like Apollo 13 happens, where condensation builds up in the spacecraft, will they survive in space like the wires and solid-state circuits did in Apollo 13?
All right.
First question. Von Braun wanted to launch a satellite in 1956. It was not part of the approved plan, and he was told by his superiors, not General Shriver. Von Braun was working for the Army, and Shriver was Air Force, but told by his Army superiors that you may not launch a satellite. And folks from Washington went down to make, and one story has it, they put sand in the upper stage to make it too heavy to orbit. But at any rate, he was denied permission to attempt orbit a satellite, and, you know, history might have been different if the United States had been first. The second question is really a technical question, well beyond my competence as a social scientist, of whether today's microelectronics are encapsulated or otherwise safe from indigenous inside the spacecraft moisture if there were that kind of accident. I just don't know the answer to that.
Brad, thank you. Mike and Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I'm really interested if your guest would have any knowledge on the rocket that went to Venus and pierced the atmosphere there and landed on the surface of Venus, and if that program, what that program was called, and if they ever plan on going back to Venus for any reason.
Okay.
Venus is a nasty place with an atmosphere full of sulfur dioxide and temperatures, I'll get the number wrong, but it's like 600, 700 degrees. So it's a very inhospitable place. We have had missions both to orbit Venus and use radar to look through the clouds, and I think it was the Soviet Union rather than the United States that actually sent a Venusian landing mission that lasted for a few seconds and then didn't work. There is a kind of underground movement in the space community now to bring back Venus into a focus of attention as an interesting place to explore, with some suggestion you could even do it with people properly protected in the Venusian atmosphere, not on the surface. So there is this little rumbling that with all the focus on Mars, maybe we should pay some attention to Venus.
Yeah. And you do talk about Mars in your book.
A little bit. I mean, so far we've only sent robotic spacecraft to orbit and land on Mars. But the book begins with Von Braun's 1954 essay on going to Mars, and it ends with an Elon Musk 2016 speech about the necessity of starting a million-person city on Mars. So Mars is there.
Yeah, it really is. I want to go back to Challenger for just a minute. I was out of country when that happened. And, you know, it was one of the few, I was away for a year, but it was one of the few times I really wished I was back home, because you kind of felt you wanted to be home. There was a feeling of one community. And I think President Reagan, who was a wonderful speaker, his speech, which I heard in St. Lucia, and Dave Potratz has got just a little clip of that. Let's hear that, what he has.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union, but the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
What a speech. And that's the speech lasted 5 minutes, and we just have a little insert from that, John. But you have the entire speech in the book.
Yes, because it was such a memorable speech. My next book, I'll put a plug in.
Sure, go ahead.
Ronald Reagan and the Space Frontier will be out in November, probably. And it is Mr. Reagan's decisions with respect to space, and it has the story of that speech and how it came to be. He thought he did a poor job of consoling the country after the speech, but overnight, all the telegrams coming into the White House congratulating him changed his mind. He said even Frank Sinatra called, and Sinatra doesn't call all the time.
So as we wind up here, what's the future of the U.S. space program?
Well, I think the private sector is going to take an increasing role in doing what the private sector does, find business opportunities, try to validate the idea that space is a place where you can make profits. There's the ongoing debate on how to organize our military space programs. It's come to be called the Space Force. And NASA's getting ready after 46 years to go somewhere, not just in circles. So I feel we'll be back with U.S. astronauts on the moon within the next decade or so.
Well, John, your current book, The Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, I found it fascinating, and I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today and talking about it. Thanks a lot, and hopefully when your next book comes out, we'll have a chance to visit again. You'll have to let me know when that when that's coming out.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks, John. John Logsdon, one of America's foremost experts on space policy and history. He got started, I didn't ask him this, but he got started. He was his PhD program had to do with the beginnings of the space program, and that's kind of how I think how he sort of got involved. He'd do a better job of explaining it than I just did. But nevertheless, if you want a fascinating read on space, The Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, edited by John Logsdon, forward by Bill Nye, the space guy, and it's a pretty interesting forward as well. Well, people are living longer and retiring earlier, and that can mean you may spend a 30-year life in retirement. So how do you want to spend those years? We'll talk about that next on the Ideas Network.